All right, we're not going to wait anymore. We're going to go. We're waiting for amendments. We're waiting for this, that, and the other. But we need to be out of here by 11:30. So I want to move, and I think we can get out of here in time. Number of things on the agenda. First, a couple bills we have to move out, and then we're going to get some reports. So we'll start with the TV report, and we'll end with the ethanol report. And if we don't get to ethanol, we can do that on another day, but I think we will probably have plenty of time. So first of all, Representative Peterson A. moves the minutes from February 19th. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye. Aye. Opposed? Minutes are adopted. Now we will go to the bill. I will move House File 2791, and you're getting a DE-1 amendment. House File 2791, and by the way, there's another amendment in your packet, but it's apparently a Little Crow transportation amendment. So if you all want to put together a transportation bill, send her off to the floor today. We can see what happens, but could be interesting. But we're not doing that. That's a mistake in the file, and that's Ertl and my... naming our light rail or our heavy rail line out in western Minnesota after a famous Indian chief. All right. The DE-1 amendment, members, and you have a spreadsheet in your file also. Remember we talked about sending on our bills yesterday, and I assume by the lack of interest by the end of the meeting by members, since there are only a couple of us left, that you decided it was okay if we just send them all on rather than rank them or delete them. But it doesn't mean you can't do it now. So the first thing I'm going to do is get the bill in the shape I want by passing the DE-1 amendment. Then we'll talk about it briefly, and we'll move it out of here. So at this point, I'd move the DE-1 amendment just to get it in the shape the author would like. All those in favor, say aye. Aye. Opposed? That amendment passes. So the bill we're using for vehicle members is my Candy Eye County Veterans Home Bill, and it's a vehicle that we're now going to attach the DE-1. So this, my 2791 language is included in here too, and as you go through it, you'll basically see the language in here is riders to all the bills we heard yesterday. I certainly will take questions, and we can answer them. We made no changes. You know, I had a question before committee, for example, on Minneapolis. We put in $26,000 for a 100-bed nursing facility. When you look at Brain or Wilmer, you see $27 million for a 90-bed facility. And someone said, why the discrepancy? And again, Minneapolis asked for 100% and then get reimbursed. The Wilmer facility is kind of being done the way I think they should, which is we give them the third, then they go get the federal money, and then they move ahead with the project. So there are differences there. But at this point, we'll just send them all on, and the bonding committee can deal with them. Representative Hausman and Tinkelstedt over there can take a look and see how they want to handle this stuff. But that's what we got. Any questions? Representative Hansen.
Mr. Chair, just to elaborate on that point, so if there is a somewhat under $1 billion bill and this is $93 million, this will compete against the packet from all the other areas in the bonding
committee. Right, and again, as fiscal committee, we need to understand how this works. Fergus Falls, by the way, I believe is the same way. They're building a 21-bed unit for $9 million. So again, you look down to Wilmer and say, how come they can do 90 beds for $7 and it's 21 beds for $9? Well, that's the full request. Technically, what we fund as a state would be a third. If we use Fergus as the example, it would be $3.3 million is what that number should be, and then say that that's available for matching the federal two-thirds, and then they need to go get that. And again, if we pay the full amount, $26 million or $10 million in the case of Fergus Falls, we will, in all likelihood, get reimbursed for that from the feds over the next budget cycle out there. But when the money comes back, it goes into our general fund. It does not go against our bond. So next year, we can't say, well, we can do another you know, $6 million because we got that refund money back so we can add to our base of what we can do. Nope, that doesn't happen in bonding. So it's a difficult situation for our finance people. Representative Hansen.
And just to follow up then, so for expectations, not every bill here that is on this list may survive in the final
right.
bill, and not every amount may be the
right.
same.
What we're doing is making a decision to, we looked at this, we think they're all, you know, fair items to do, they're all, you know, worth talking about, but we're going to send a bonding committee. Obviously, as Representative Hansen and I believe, are the only two on here that are on bonding. We saw probably over $4 billion and growing of requests, because some bills are still being introduced, for under $1 billion bonding bill. And so not only should the expectation be that this $93 million will shrink to at least maybe a quarter in the bonding committee if that's applied across the board, but in fact, because we're doing a larger bridge bill, actually in the transportation bill tomorrow, and other things which will come out of the bonding bill, it may be less than a fourth of these requests that end up in the bonding bill, but certainly we're going to have that discussion in the bonding committee and on the floor when you all weigh in. So it's not the expectation that $93 million or $100 million of the $900 million bonding bill will be Veterans Affairs. So don't anyone believe that, because we're just sending everything up for the next committee. All right. All those in favor, let's see, I'll renew my motion, House File 2791, as amended, be referred to the Capital Investment Committee. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? That bill passes. Thank you, members. That's one chore done. The next one, Representative Otremba has a bill. This bill, members, from here, Representative Representative Trumbull moves House File 2683 for recommends it to pass and go to Committee on Finance. Representative Otremba, to your bill.
Thank you. You've just moved the bill. What we are doing is legislature has the education. What? I'm supposed to talk louder.
Use your outdoor voice.
Outdoor voice. Okay. The Minnesota Agricultural Education Leadership Council expires on June 30th. Of 2008. This bill brings this this council to 2013. So on my right is Julie Test, and she's the executive director, and she will give us a synopsis of why we need to expand this.
All right, welcome to the committee, and introduce yourself for the tape and proceed.
Good morning, thank you. Chairman and members, my name for the record is Julie Tesh, and I'm Executive Director of the Minnesota Agricultural Education Leadership Council. We refer to ourselves as MEALC, so that's how I will proceed. And I'm just going to give you a brief update, and thank you for allowing us to come in today and give you a brief update. Like Representative Otremba said, we are set to sunset on June 30th of 2008. We were originally created in 1997. At that time, we had a three-year time span, and so in 2000, we came back, received a three-year extension, and in 2003 we received a five-year extension. So that is what we are here seeking, is another five-year extension. We feel we've done a lot of work, but we still have a lot to accomplish. Just to give you a brief synopsis of what MEALC is, we are a 17-member legislative council, and like I said, we were created in 1997. Our problem that we address is that Minnesota obviously is a leading state in agriculture, yet we are still facing a critical shortage in agriculture students, teachers, and well-trained workers. And while we have increased enrollment at the University of Minnesota in agricultural education and our colleges of agriculture, we still have industry telling us we need more people. We need more people for jobs. Our mission statement is very simple. MEALC provides leadership to expand and grow agricultural education in Minnesota. Our key objectives is to increase enrollment in agricultural education programs in Minnesota. You might be asking, what is agricultural education? What is this all about? This is at the secondary level, your high school programs, your FSA programs, post-secondary level, and then also our farm business management programs run through MinSU. We're here to increase the scope of agricultural education geographically and programmatically, basically to increase programs. Also, we coordinate activities to improve programming through increased partnering of various organizations. We also strengthen the high school ag ed programs and FSA chapters, and we do act as an umbrella organization. We have a lot of organizations out there that are passionate about agricultural education, and we try to bring those all together. Since this is the Finance Committee, the funding for meal fees, in 1997, the legislature provided a biennial special appropriation to the U of M base level funding for the enhancement of agricultural education programming. The original allocation for meal fee was $300,000. Now, with budget cuts and whatnot, our meal fee operations, scholarships, and original grants program, we are at $266,445. In that bill as well, I don't have it on the slide, but in that bill as well is $200,000 that also goes to the University of Minnesota. That pays for a faculty member, that pays for a recruiter, that pays for a graduate student, because 10 years ago we had one faculty member, and the numbers there were low. They were talking about shutting the program down. The University of Minnesota Twin Cities campus is the only place in the state of Minnesota you can receive a teaching license to be an agricultural educator. So that was a very vital thing that we wanted to save. Last year, you were kind enough to give us a funding increase. After 10 years, we had not come back for a funding increase. And our funding was increased per year $250,000. And that was not for operation money. That was for special projects, grants, initiatives. If you recall, last year we had, we came to you with a statewide online curriculum that is now functioning. That is one thing that we've helped fund. And it is a phenomenal tool for our teachers that they have used greatly, and they're starting to get online with that. So our total budget this year is $516,445. And like I said before, we are housed at the University of Minnesota, right in the Ag Ed department on the St. Paul campus. Give you some quick statistics where we're at on Ag Ed students. We have 90 undergraduate students at the University of Minnesota, Twin Cities, and then in Crookston, they take classes via ITVC. And so we have students there, and then we also have 2+2 partner institutions, and those are community colleges around the state. So your Ridgewaters, your South Central Colleges, they can do 2 years there and then easily transfer to the university. We have 50 graduate students, master's level and PhD, and right now we have 8 student teachers out in the field. They are in their second week, doing very well. We have a new recruiter that we just hired this last fall, and we do have an open faculty position. So we are looking to hire a person to start in the fall. Some more statistics, secondary-wise, we have 23,000 estimated total 7 through 12 enrollment. Where we're really trying to grow is in the middle school, because as you all know, students are getting bogged down with way too many classes and requirements. We're trying to get them early so they're interested in Ag Ed right away. Our enrollment in FSA is 8,750. For the 07-08 school year, we have 184 Ag Ed programs around the state and 230 teachers in those programs. We have a lot of schools with multiple programs. On the farm business management end of things, we have 80 farm business management instructors across Minnesota. There are 85 sites. Many of our instructors actually will go and have 2 sites. And then there's 8 college campuses that they work with, and there are 5 regional deans that work with that program. So over some of our 10-year accomplishments very quickly, the revitalization of the University of Minnesota Ag Ed program is number one. We have been very happy with how things have gone. The scholarship program is enhanced. Of course, tuition is increasing, so we have to entice them. We lose quite a few students to South Dakota, River Falls, and so to entice them to stay in Minnesota to receive their teaching license is very valuable. Our recruitment efforts are greatly enhanced, our agricultural education staff, and our 2+2 network. It's getting harder and harder to get into the University of Minnesota, and I'm a graduate of there, and I support them greatly, but we have a lot of students who can't get into the university right now, and so we're really encouraging them to go to the community college and then transfer to the university to get their degree. Our grant program is something we're also very proud of. We have awarded over $1.2 million in competitive grants, and those have gone directly back into school districts, into your local school districts. We have school districts out there who, in their ag ed programs, didn't have basic things like books. They didn't have, if they were doing a welding class, they didn't have welding gloves. They didn't have safety equipment. So we were able to provide funding for that through a competitive process. So far on replicated numbers, we've affected 105,000 students. And there's many more that we've affected that we just do not have documented. And we've had the revitalization of dozens of programs. It's really fun to see all of a sudden you have a program that is about to shut their doors, and now there's a line up to get into the program. There's a waiting list, so it's really fun to see. The creation of the Academy for Sciences and Agriculture, I know the committee last year went out to AFSA, and you'll notice they have a name change. It was the Agriculture and Food Sciences Academy. They did switch it to the Academy for Sciences and Agriculture for marketing purposes. They still are an agricultural high school doing very well. And then we are also working with some of this new funding we received. Last year, we're creating an integrated program at the Lake Nokomis schools in South Minneapolis in their elementary areas. So we're very excited about that. And then we're also working on transition planning and funding for farm business management. We're going to lose about 50% of our FBM instructors in the next 5 years due to retirement. And that concerns us greatly. And so we are working on a transition plan and trying to get new instructors in there so we don't lose clients and so that our farmers are still well served. Some more accomplishments is our increased leadership opportunities for students and teachers. We've done a lot of leadership training, and you're going to be seeing students here tomorrow. And then we also started a policy fellow program. I have 5 students who will be coming down here this session to learn about policy and learn about agriculture. We also have a scholarship program. So far, 166 students have been awarded post-secondary scholarships to study agricultural education, and we've awarded $170,000 to date. The nice thing is that if a student does go to Crookston to school, they match our scholarship, which is a very nice enhancement to that. Like I stated before, we have implemented the online statewide agricultural education curriculum, and the nice thing about that is it does crosswalk our science and math standards. We are a local control state, but many of our local school districts are awarding ed classes for science credit, and they have to meet high standards, and we train our teachers to do that. So right now online, what we have available is natural resource science, animal, plant, and soil science, biological applications, and agriculture. And we're also looking at agricultural economics. We have a great training program with the Minnesota Council on Economic Education to teach our teachers how to teach agricultural economics to receive economics credit. And it is a resounding success. The classes are full. Future, why do we still need to be here? We need to continue the integration of science, economics, and math. In order to stay viable, we unfortunately in agricultural education cannot teach how to plant corn and to raise cows. Those days are over. We need to integrate, and we need to learn how to do this. More agricultural instructor recruitment. Nationwide, we are at a severe shortage in teachers. In Minnesota right now, we're holding our own, but like I said, we're going to have a 50% turnover rate in 5 years. So we are working with the university in a new initiative called Change Lives, Teach Agriculture. That will be kicking off at our State FSA convention this year. And then also we're looking at agricultural education program expansion. We're very happy that Redwood Falls this year started a new ag program. They didn't have a program for about 15 years, and they decided the community supported it, and they started back up. What we really need to do is get data collection. Are our ag classes actually meeting the needs of our students, and are they testing as good or better in science, math, and economics? And we're working on that data with our new online system. And then we need to also continue our curriculum development and teacher training. Right now we work with the Council on Economic Education. Our teachers have been able to take classes at the Mayo Clinic on genomics, animal science, plant science, biofuels we're working on, and also food science workshops. And I also just wanted to put a plug in that tomorrow is FFA Day at the Capitol, so if you see the blue jackets walking around, please say hello. I hope we've encouraged many of them to come and meet with you, so hopefully they will be doing that. So with that, I'll take any questions you may have.
Thank you. Questions to the author or the witness. Members, the reason this bill is here, Times Representative Finstead, this is, while we did fund these programs, this biennium, which goes till end of June 2009, by extending this, we're creating a tail, because these now will be built into base budgets into the next biennium. So it doesn't affect our budgets this year. We don't have to worry about that. But as a fiscal committee, which you're What you're doing is committing to TALES in the Department of Agriculture in the next biennium. So when we come back next year and look at our budgets, you'll see that start showing up in the base budget or continue to be in the base budget. So, and we will send it up to finance, and they will deal with those TALES, them in Ways and Means, as we move forward. And they'll get a look at this, too. So that's what we're doing with this bill here today, and that's why it's in finance, because really the policy items at this point don't change. It's just a continuation. Any questions? Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you for your presentation. I just have a question. Do you have a sense of how many, and maybe you mentioned this, how many high schools actually do provide ag education and how that's increased in the last couple of years?
Mm-hmm. Chairman and Representative Poppy, yes, actually, let me get my numbers here. We've actually helped said, you know, there's a common myth out there that agricultural education programs are decreasing. And actually, we've helped steady the last 10 years. You know, we might lose one, but we gain one. And so right now, we are at, where am I at? Here. We're at 184 ag ed programs. Last year, we were at 185. So we did lose two, but we gained Redwood Falls. So we're holding steady. It's something that we're working on right now. We have two kind of very differing views on how we're approaching things. We're trying to get into the urban and suburban areas more. And we're trying really hard to do that. It's just hard trying to find the right in. But we're also looking at sparsely populated areas. Something we're looking at for this next year is that basically if you cut Minnesota in half, the western half, we're looking at breaking into five pods. And we're looking at doing sparsely populated agricultural education. We have a lot of very rural areas that do not have ag education. And how can we work together with technology and with education and deliver ag ed to these areas so that they do come home to a rural area and provide local economies. And so we're looking at new and innovative ways. We realize that it's really hard with budgets to have schools add an ag program. We are not a key program to have. We require a lot of equipment. And even if we have Perkins funding, we still need money. So we're trying to figure out ways also to work with community colleges and how we can offer an ag program working with them as well. So 184 programs we have.
Okay, before we move out, you've got the FFA week, and did we remind people tomorrow night? Is that tomorrow night?
Yes, tomorrow night.
You want to remind the committee?
Yes, if you have not been to AFTA, to the Ag High School, please come out 5:30 to 7:30 tomorrow night. We are having an open house to celebrate NEOC's 10 years, and there will be tours of the school, and please come out. There's a short program at 6:15, so you are more than welcome. It's located in Vadnais Heights, just off of 694.
So for members, some of us will be going out there for the program at 6:15 at least, and it'd be nice to see some other members out there. I know, I'm sure Representative Tremba's going there. She's on the board, I believe.
And I probably have a couple places in my car.
And she'll give you a ride. And she'll buy you dinner. Oh, did I say that out loud? All right. Representative Tremba renews her motion that House File 2683 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Finance. All those in favor say aye. Aye. Opposed? Bill passes. Thank you, Representative Tremba.
Thank you.
Now, members, we're going to move to the Board of Animal Health. Mr. Dr. Hartman and anyone else he's got that are coming in your files, and I know you've gotten it on your internet, I believe, but there's a news release that went out on Tuesday, as well as some information on cattle movement and other things. But members, what we want to do is start laying the groundwork here. If you remember last year, the board was before us. We funded their budget, and their budgets were based on what they perceived the need to be for testing and other things over a two-year period of time. Certainly, as we move to the March 28th deadline for finance committees, we want to start understanding what you think your needs will be to get you to the end of biennium, if they're still fine and if they're not. But more importantly, we want to start hearing about what's going on, how does that affect Minnesota, and what are we going to have to do to address it before the end of the session here. So we're giving you an opportunity to inform us, lay some groundwork, and get the committee thinking about this, because this is an issue we're going to have to address. So whoever wants to start, welcome to the committee, introduce yourself, and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee. My name is Joe Martin. I'm Assistant Commissioner with the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. I'm just going to say a few words. Dr. Hartman will deliver the majority of the testimony in relation to what's happening with TB. But just as an overview, this is really, while the Board of Animal Health is the lead agency, this is really a team effort between the Minnesota Department of Agriculture, Minnesota DNR, and also it's important to remember that the USDA is a major player in this, as they're making a lot of decisions, and we're beholden to some of their decisions along this process. But why we're here today is we found four herds in 12 months, which in the USDA Code of Federal Regulations calls for a downgrade in status. We were at a modified accredited advance, and we go to modified accredited. What that means is further restriction on movement of cattle out of state. As economic impact, as estimate, we move over 200,000 cattle across state lines. They could be feeder cattle, they could be breeding animals, dairy heifers, and as an average, TB test is about $10 per test, and then $5 to $10 in veterinary charges. So the numbers add up quick. Also important to note is this does now have an impact on dairy producers. At a modified accredited advance, dairy is not captured, but under a modified accredited, under the USDA Code of Federal Regulations, it calls for either every dairy animal to be tested annually or an alternative. And just to back up a little bit, the entire state is going to be downgraded to modified accredited status. So this is what sets the stage. Obviously, we're working really closely with the USDA. We don't think it's necessarily reasonable to test every dairy cow in this state every year. We're looking at it on a risk-based assessment of trying to develop an alternative plan so marketing of fluid milk is not disrupted. We don't see any short-term impact for the marketing of fluid milk, but once again, we'll be working really closely with USDA. And I would just, I think an important point we sort of forget about is we get caught up in what's the impact to the producers. We don't want to forget the consumer message in this is that this really is an animal health issue, not a food safety issue, primarily because the milk supply is safe because of normal pasteurization. If any TB organisms would, by chance, get into the milk, normal pasteurization does kill the organism. And then also on the meat side, the TB organism is not prevalent in muscle cuts. And we also have inspectors looking for it at facilities. And if those two safeguards happen to be breached, just normal cooking would destroy the TB organism. So with that, I'll stop. And I believe Dr. Hartman will.
Dr. Hartman, we'll let you do your presentation. I'm sure there'll be questions, but I'm sure you'll cover a lot of maybe what we're thinking in our heads right now. So introduce yourself and proceed.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Bill Hartman. I'm the Executive Director of the Board of Animal Health and the State Veterinarian. And I want to thank you for giving us a few moments this morning to tell you about recent events with bovine TB. I'm going to take you back just a little bit to start with. Minnesota was first eliminated this disease from cattle in 1971. A lot of effort towards doing that, and then became a TB-free state in 1976. So we went about 30 years without finding any of this disease in Minnesota. And in the United States, this disease has been virtually eliminated. There are a few places where it keeps popping up, but virtually eliminated. Even Texas is free of this disease now. We found our first infected herd in 2005, in the summer of 2005. We found that through our surveillance system, which is animals examined at slaughter. Subsequent to that, we found four more, and these were all, and still remain, all beef cattle herds in a small area in northwestern Minnesota. That fall, because of what happened in Michigan, DNR did surveillance around our infected herds, and that first year they found one infected deer. So we, in addition to having a challenge with the cattle up there, we have a challenge with the deer as well. Because of those events, Minnesota lost its accredited free status for bovine tuberculosis. We're now at a modified accredited advanced status. That happened in January of 2006. Last fall, in the testing that we do, and the majority of the cattle up there are beef cattle, and majority of them are tested in the fall, and that's why all the activity in the fall. We found two infected herds last fall, and so we were able to maintain our status and continue with our project. Our plan was to finish our investigation, depopulate the infected herds, trace those herds that bought and sold animals from it, test them, prove that there was no infection anywhere else in the state of Minnesota, and we have done that. Both DNR and the Board of Animal Health have worked together to test 1,550 cattle herds in the state of Minnesota, and they all tested negative outside of this area up in northwestern Minnesota where the infection is found. And DNR did statewide surveillance of deer as well to show that there was no infection anywhere else in the state. We also, when we find these infected herds, we do area testing. So we draw 10-mile circles around those infected herds and test all the herds in that area. And outside of these 11 herds, we've not found any infection. Then we were going to establish movement restrictions on the herds within this core area where the deer are infected, wait 2 years, and get our TB-free status back. And people remind me if we'd have quit finding infection after that first year, we'd be back to free status already. Recent developments aren't going to allow us to do that. The limit in a modified accredited advanced state is 3 infected herds in a year. We just announced our fourth herd yesterday, and I think you have a news release that talks about that. These herds, if you look at the map, they're all way up in the northwestern part of the state. To give you some reference, I've driven up there many times, as has Representative Olin. It's about a 7-hour drive from here to get there. This is a close-up of that showing, and the red dots are the herds that we found previous to this fall. The blue dots are the 4 herds that we found during this fall. And I don't have a pointer here, but if you look up, there's a red and a blue dot at the bottom, and then there's a red and a blue dot above that. That blue dot is the last infected herd we found, the 4th infected herd. Now, if we superimpose upon, there it is, that pointer shows it to you. If we superimpose these areas that DNR has established in this area, that red circle is the core zone, and that's a 2-mile radius circle around every infected deer that's been found. And the management area, that blue area around that, is a 10-mile circle around any infected deer that was found. And then you can see that the majority of the infected herds and the infected deer are right in that core zone, and we've never found any infected deer outside of that core zone. So it's a very localized event up there. What this status thing, this lays out the state statuses. We were at accredited free, we're now at modified accredited advanced, and we will drop to modified accredited when USDA publishes the new rule. These are the steps that you take when you eliminate this disease from your state. So we're down two with this event.
Representative Hampton has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Dr. Hartman. Looking at the map, that's also an area where there's some wild elk populations. Have there been any testing of the wild elk population there?
Looks like we got the DNR coming to the table. Introduce yourself and
Mr. Chair and members. I'm Ed Bogus, Deputy Director of Fish and Wildlife for the DNR, and I'm happy to be before an Agriculture Committee today. Representative Hansen, we do have elk in this area, and we have tested all of the dead elk that we've been able to get our hands on in that area. It's only been a few. I don't know the exact number. So far, it's not been, TB has not been found in the elk in this area.
Okay. Proceed, Mr. Dr. Harper.
This slide just shows the implications of changing status to modified accredited. On the left are the different classes of cattle. And then in the first column is what we're doing currently as a modified accredited advanced state, and on the right, modified accredited. And I think you have this in a handout as well. The big deal is that when you're going to be selling breeding cattle outside of Minnesota now, instead of just having to test the individuals that are leaving the state, you would have to have had a whole herd test within the last year. And then the other one is the feeder cattle movement. Right now, feeder cattle are not required to be tested to move to other states. With this downgrade, they would be required to be tested. Joe Martin talked about the pasteurized milk ordinance and the potential for testing dairy herds there. So we've got a couple of options now in what we do with this. One option would be to leave the whole state as modified accredited. What would be necessary then is we would have a tremendous amount of testing all over the state, in my opinion, in areas where we know we've already proven there is no disease. And that doesn't make sense. I think we need to focus our attention to the area where we know there's infection and put all of our resources there. If we were to leave the whole state modified accredited, these restrictions would be in place a minimum of 2 years. And then each year we would have to stay below that 3-herd limit, or that 2 years would continue to be extended until we had 2 years where we got no more than 2 herds or 3 herds in a year. The alternative to that would be to do what Michigan did, and that is to divide the state up into sections. In Michigan, they have 3 sections. They have an accredited free area in the Upper Peninsula, and then the majority of the state is modified, accredited, advanced, and then in the area where they have infection in the deer is their modified, accredited area. We've taken some looks at this, what this might entail. We're working with USDA to establish how big this zone would have to be. In our opinion, based on the control of the disease, an area something like what you see here would be adequate to control the disease in this area. I think we have about 300 herds. And then this is a little bit bigger area that is a possibility as well, and there's about 500 herds in that area. So we're at least looking at this. The Board of Animal Health had their quarterly meeting last week and passed a motion to direct me to move in the direction of split state status and to start working with USDA on the zones. What's required is that we're working right now with USDA to do a risk assessment. And what they're looking at is the risk, if we establish this zone, that the disease would get out of that area into other parts of Minnesota, or the risk to get out to other parts of the United States. And then once that's done, we would have to implement this area, put in controls in place like this was another state, and then we would apply to USDA for this status, and then eventually sign a memorandum of understanding with USDA.
Dr. Hartman, if we go to a zone area, obviously it affects the way we have to test, which is a big deal, particularly to our dairy guys down south that were in here yesterday. Does it affect, you talked originally 200,000 cattle move out of state. Does the zones affect that movement, or is the state still considered an MA state, and that movement, are there tests required then if, you know, we're moving cattle to Nebraska for slaughter or something? Do those cattle coming out of a TB MA state have to be tested?
Mr. Chairman, initially the whole state will become MA, and then the whole state will have to meet those requirements that we talked about. So any feeder cattle leaving Minnesota would have to be tested. If they're going directly to a state or federal inspected slaughter plant, they would not have to be tested.
And what about animals coming out of the zone then?
Well, so that's what it would be if the whole state were MA. What we would apply for is a split state status, where this area that you're looking at would be modified accredited, and the rest of the state, we're going to make the case that they should be TB free. Whether that'll be accepted or not, I don't know. If not, the fallback point would be modified accredited advanced, in which case then the same restrictions that are in place right now would be in place for the majority of the state. So you would not have to test feeder cattle leaving the state other than from that MA zone. From this MA zone, though, to get out of there to other places in Minnesota, those restrictions would be in place.
And can you give me some more information on how you go about drawing the lines? Does that take legislative action, or is that an action you can take as Board of Animal Health? And do you show up north before you do it and hold hearings? Because if you look at that line, there's some herds that are going to be within footsteps of that line on either side and really affect, I would suspect, the way they market either north or out of state. And I didn't even ask about Canada, what's going on with that, because obviously that's there too.
Mr. Chairman, we are having four meetings, one in Thief River Falls, one in Bagley, one in Bemidji, I think, and the
Black Duck.
So we are having four meetings up there next week, and we are going to hear what people have to say and listen to them. I think the boundaries aren't going to be decided by us. We can propose them to USDA, and they're going to make the final decision on how big that area has to be. But I agree with you. There are going to be people across the road who are going to be in different parts of the zone, and it's going to be difficult to draw those lines.
So again, is it a USDA decision, and we don't have to do anything legislatively?
Mr. Chairman, I would say that's correct.
And how does this affect Canadian shipments?
Mr. Chairman, that is monitored. That would be international shipment of cattle, so that would be handled by USDA. And there is a border port, I'm going to say, and I think it's in Baudette, but there's very little movement of livestock through there. Most of the movement of livestock in and out of Canada is through Pembina, which is in just on the northeast tip of North Dakota.
Representative Olin. Couple questions. Use your microphone, please.
Thank you, Chairman. I just got a couple questions, and I'm not sure where I'm going with it. Dr. Hartman, what is the number of herds actually in that 10-mile core?
Dr. Hartman?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Olin, I'll go back to the slide. If you look at that red circle, there are 19 cattle herds in that area, and at one time, I don't know what the number is today, but we estimated there were about 1,000 head of cattle in that zone. In the blue area, there are about 54 cattle herds, and I don't have an estimate on the number of cattle there.
Sam Olin?
And the reason I asked is I have been contacted by some people up in that area, and it's not a unanimous, but there are some that even are suggesting eradicate all the cattle in that area. Would that make any difference?
And Mr. Hartman, maybe you can talk about eradication of herds and or eventually we want to hear what's going on with DNR and their fencing budgets up there, too.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Olin, there has been discussion about would it be beneficial to remove the cattle from that area? From a strictly disease control point of view, it would aid in the elimination of the disease. We know it's in deer in that area. And a lot of efforts are going into controlling the interaction between the deer and the cattle to minimize the impact, to stop the cattle herds from getting infected. So it certainly wouldn't. It would enhance the effort to eliminate the disease. We're not sure right now with these recent herds why they're showing up infected. These herds, most of them, this is their third herd test. They've had two negative tests prior to this. And so there is the possibility that the deer are reinfecting the cattle.
Representative Owen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dr. Hartman, one other question. And the other question basically is, if you were to just take that area, now I'm sitting in the northern area and I'm in the worst possible situation, but looking at it statewide, if we got out under the modified accreditive, worst case scenario in the rest of the state, if we got separated these areas, we'd be out of the dairy herds, right? Basically, nothing happens to dairy herds under modified accredited.
Dr. Hartman?
Or the advance, I mean.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Olin, yes, if the rest of the state became modified accredited advance, then the pasteurized milk ordinance wouldn't have any requirements. If you're an accredited free state or a modified accredited advanced state, there's no dairy herd testing requirements.
One last comment then. So basically, speaking from a northern position without being obstinate, just wanting to protect my area, the only true way we're going to ever help the entire state is to separate somehow, wherever you draw a line.
Dr. Hartman? Mr. Chairman and Representative Olin, it looks like the best way to get the majority of the cattle industry back into business as quickly as possible. Representative Welty.
Thank you, Chair Junkie. And
now we're going to hear from the southern part of the
Yes, Dr. Hartman. Could you please tell me what additional resources will be needed that you anticipate from the Board of Animal Health, from Department of Agriculture, and from DNR if we do not go to a split state status? So what I'm looking at is, right now, what resources have you been putting in? But if we don't go to split state status and the whole state gets consumed by this, what additional resources will be needed?
Dr. Arvin? Mr. Chairman and Representative Welty, if we don't go to split state status, the issues I think that will come up is the amount of testing that's necessary to move cattle interstate. I don't think we have enough veterinarians in the state if they're doing to do all the testing that would be required. So you either have to attract more private practitioners to do this testing. They have to work harder, or you have to bring in government veterinarians to do some of the testing. So that would certainly be an issue, is the amount of testing that would be necessary. I don't know that it would change from the point of view of the of government veterinarians. We would need additional. What happens when private practicing veterinarians go out and do testing is, in about half of those herds that we test, we find animals that are suspicious. And so my employees and the federal veterinarians in Minnesota will go out then and do follow-up tests. If we have this more testing going on, we're going to have more of that activity. So we would need more employees to be doing that activity.
Representative Wells.
Thank you, Dr. Hartman. And this point was brought up by some of the constituents living in my area, and they said, essentially, if we don't go to a split state status, we're going to be using our resources all throughout the state, when we really could be focusing those resources on a small area and targeting, you know, the dollars to that area that we would have. And so I think you're making that point. Is there any other comments that you want to make along those lines about the benefit of going to a split state status in that region and focusing the resources, and what you would do if you had just a small area to work with it?
Dr. Hartman? Mr. Chairman and Representative Welty, you're exactly right. We just spent a year testing cattle herds throughout the state, and we proved, and it was a study designed by USDA that they required us to do to show that there's no infection in the rest of the state. So I think I mentioned earlier, why would we continue to test cattle in this area? And by the way, that costs $1.5 million of your federal tax dollars to test those herds. So having established that, it makes sense for us to focus our testing in the area we know the disease is in.
Zimmel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and this is just basically a comment. I really don't know that we have a whole lot of choice in whether we're going to split the north and the south, because your costs, and we got our veterinarians up in the northern part running wild just on this issue alone, and I don't know that you can afford to do that statewide. They have several other concerns that they have to take care of, and you're really stretching, just knowing the local veterinarians we got, we are really stretching them right now, and if everybody had to be testing everything, it's a strain on your local veterinarians, believe me.
Dr. Hartman, you have more, or are you nearing your end of your part?
Mr. Chairman, I am done unless there's more questions.
Okay. And just for people, we'll skip the ethanol today and move that into next week. Ms. Cheney, you guys need a break from the office anyway. You've got to sit in the Ag Committee. It's quite a nice day, isn't it? So,
but now we want to hear, there's been some discussion. I know DNR is here, and I want to hear more about the conversations between DNR and the Board of Animal Health. We put some budgets, Mr. Bogus, over to you last year for fencing and herd control, and I know there's been some discussions on perhaps relocating those budgets this year, and can you talk about those conversations and what we may be looking at doing this year, one of you or both of you?
Mr. Chair, I can start off. DNR has gotten two appropriations, one in each of the last bienniums, $54,000 each biennium one time to do fencing in the TB area. It's limited to $5,000 per fencing project. Dr. Hartman talked about 19 cattle farms in that core area on the map, and we're working with all of those cattle farms. We've got installed fences on somewhere around 12, and we've got specifications and supplies and materials en route for the remaining farms, and should have those done when the ground thaws this spring and summer. The issue, though, is with the $5,000 per farm, we're fencing primarily stored forage areas. There's other feeding areas. It's getting, we think, more. We've got some fencing expertise because we fence orchards and specialty crops and things like that for controlling damage. But getting into disease management and livestock husbandry, we're thinking that it's really not DNR's primary role to be getting into that aspect. And just given the positive farms that continue to show up, we really need to be more aggressive on this deer-cattle interface and trying to separate not only the deer from the stored forage, but the deer from feeding with the livestock, and that could take significantly more resources. So we've been having discussions with Department of Agriculture and Board of Animal Health on some potential additional authorities, and there could be some additional costs. The administration, I'll let Mr. Martin maybe talk about it, but we don't have a budget in the governor's budget for any of this at this time. But we're talking about additional needs that could address this deer cattle interface and try to minimize the potential for deer transmitting back to cattle that possibly could be occurring in this area.
So if you if we are going to have to move budgets and other things, again, you know our deadlines here, and you can all work with that. And work with Representative Olin if there's some language that needs to be carried. I think he'd be the best one to pursue that. And obviously you'd have to sit down eventually with Representative Carlson, the finance chair, and just figure out how we can make some adjustments if we have to. So, questions, members? TV zones? Money's needed, and again, we're expecting you to come back shortly, at least visit with us internally on what your needs might be. So again, we've got till roughly the end of March to do any anything we need to here at a committee level, and we certainly want to do whatever it takes to clear this up and start moving us back the other way. It's been, I know, a frustrating time. Representative Welty?
What is the DNR's position on, and is it possible to try to eradicate the deer herds in that area? I know you're doing the fencing to try to keep them away as well, but kind of going back to the Asian carp issue and some of the other invasive species that we've had, it seems like sometimes we don't necessarily step up to the plate when we should in order to just do the job. Is it possible to eradicate some of the deer herds in that area?
Mr. Bogus, besides selling, what's the committee know what you are doing for deer herd management? Are you selling bonus licenses up there? Are you going out or others going out and thinning herds, or what's the activities up there?
Mr. Chair and Representative Walty, we've been very aggressive trying to manage the deer herd. We see maybe a narrow window of opportunity to try to wipe this disease out. We know we can always produce more deer, so we've been very aggressive. Despite some local opposition, there's people that have invested in land, specifically for deer hunting, but we think their short-term sacrifice is something that we have to do. What we've been doing in this area, to get at the chairman's question, this year we had a special early hunt for antlerless deer only in that area in October with firearms. We had the regular season hunt in that area, and then we had a special 16-day hunt that started at the end of December and ran through the middle of January. For the last 2 years, we've had sharpshooters, federal sharpshooters. We're working with USDA as well, APHIS, In addition to their veterinary services branch that Dr. Hartman primarily works with, has a wildlife services branch that deals with wildlife damage control, and they have specially trained staff, and they've also provided some funding for sharpshooting. Last February, we did a sharpshooting effort. I don't remember the exact numbers, but between 400 and 500 deer were taken after the hunting season with sharpshooting. After the January special hunt concluded, we did a survey in this core area and found our estimate was still that there were about 800 deer in that area. There had been about 950 in that area the year before. To give you the short answer to your question, we really don't know how to eradicate deer in the natural landscape completely. It's probably not possible to do. But we can lower the density. We were surprised that it wasn't lowered more. Some of that may have been influx of deer into the area. It's a relatively small area, and they do move. So we've got sharpshooters on the ground again as we speak right now. They're having kind of tough conditions with the wind chill conditions they've been dealing with. They took 40-some deer last week. They're at it again this week, and they'll be going at least for the rest of this month. The deer are getting tougher to get. They're just a very wary creature, and as we put the pressure on them, they're getting harder and harder to get. But we are very aggressively going after the deer in this area, and we'll continue to do that. We've had the full support of the Minnesota Deer Hunters Association. They recognize the potential. If this should become endemic in deer, as it has in Michigan, then we'll always be dealing with it. We think we have an opportunity. Every deer that we found, as Dr. Hartman pointed out, has been in that small core area. They've all been older animals. We take some encouragement from that, but we don't know that there couldn't be this back and forth going. It's pretty clear that originally the deer got it from the cattle, but it's not clear now whether it's starting to go back and forth, and that's why we think this deer-cattle interface issue is so important to address.
Before we go on, Representative Welty, I want to let people know we've been joined by a bunch of blue shirts here, and they are the Red River Valley Emerging Leadership Program. These are community leaders in agriculture and natural resources, so this is a very topical discussion for them. They're from counties this year, Becker, Clay, Clearwater, Grant, Kitsa, Manoman, Marshall, Norman, West Ottertail, Pennington, Polk, Red Lake, Roseau, Stevens, and Wilkins. So obviously they're a very focused audience, and now that one of their reps wants to talk too, but you're down the list. Representative Welty.
just one follow-up question. You said that we have a small and effective window that we can, try to eradicate the TB. If the DNR had the resources it needed, what would be your goal? What would you need, and what would be your goal if you had the resources you needed in this area to deal with this situation? Because I'm kind of getting the sense that we know sort of what needs to be done. Yes, it is a challenge because deer move around and the herds are hard to control, but there may be potential for being more effective. Tell me what resources you would need from the state in order to be effective in that area.
Mr. Bolt.
Mr. Chair and Representative Welty, from the DNR's perspective, we've been getting some federal grant money for the sharpshooting effort. We're managing the hunting through, and one of the things I didn't mention is we created a special TB zone for deer hunting, and we're basically selling deer licenses as many as people want for the cost of issuing the licenses, $2-3 each, and they can take as many deer as they want. But so through hunting, sharpshooting, The one unmet need that we see right now is it's just not going to be practical to eliminate the deer in this area, no matter how many resources we throw at it. Wisconsin attempted that in their CWD zone, and it just is not possible to do with wild deer in this size of a landscape. But we really think the key right now is separating the deer and the cattle feeding. If the deer are feeding like livestock with livestock, we think that's the primary way that the disease will be perpetuated in the deer. And if we can get the deer feeding more like deer and browsing on twigs and buds and things like that and not feeding in the hay with the cattle, that's our best chance to stop this disease.
Representative Hanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Bogus, so was that last statement that the DNR would be supporting a ban on deer feeding?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hanson, that's another thing I forgot to mention, is we have banned deer feeding in this area. We did get legislative direction a couple of years ago to restrict feeding in this area, and it's a much larger area than what you see here. It's more like the first area that Dr. Hartman showed for the possible split status area. It's roughly an area like this where we have prohibited deer feeding for the last couple of years. We've been very aggressively trying to enforce that. We do aerial surveys. It's pretty easy to spot those feeding areas. You see the wagon wheel spokes of deer trails leading into a feeding site when there's snow on the ground, and we've been going after people that have been feeding deer, and we're starting to get some pretty good compliance. So, but that is a key, is to prohibit the intentional feeding of deer. The remaining issue that we have is the unintentional feeding of deer when they're just putting the feed out in the fields for the cattle, and the deer are coming in, and they're all feeding there together.
Representative Hanson.
My original question was going to be, I think Dr. Hartman, you had said there are about 1,000 cattle within the red line. And Mr. Bogus, you said there were 950 brought it down, but they come in and out. So we've got almost an equivalent amount. Mr. Bogus, are you keeping track of both the state and the federal costs here in terms of this, so you could provide the committee with the total bill, the total public cost for trying to eradicate venison from both the federal and the state side?
Mr. Chair and Representative Hanson, we are tracking that. We've gotten some general fund appropriations for TB management. We've gotten federal grants for TB management, and then we have a surveyed health account that comes from a portion of the deer license fee that originally was established to deal with CWD. That we've also used some of that, but we do have a complete accounting for all that we've spent so far.
Representative Hanson.
And at some point, will that cost exceed the cost of buying out the cattle herd?
And Bogus for Dr. Hartman. Interesting question.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hanson, the estimated cost for eliminating cattle in that core zone, so about 1,000 head of cattle, you know, it's going to be somewhere between $1 and $2 million. What is involved in that is if they all went to slaughter, there would be some salvage value from the cows, so that would minimize the impact that it would have. There are people up in that core zone who like to raise cattle, have been doing it their entire lives, and plan on passing it down to their children. So there's some issues involved there beyond money.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll limit these comments. DNR is making an effort to do it. Now, I've talked to deer hunters, and I've talked to cattlemen, and I know that I can find people pointing fingers back and forth and pointing fingers at DNR and everybody else known to mankind up there, but we need to find a quicker and easier solution than we're doing right now. And I'm not faulting them for their efforts, because they are trying. But it's an uphill battle no matter what you're doing right there. And it gets really uphill when you start hearing deer hunters complaining that cattlemen are letting them eat, and you hear cattlemen complaining that the deer hunters are sliding, still feeding them behind the scenes. And you hear those kind of complaints. They haven't always caught the guys, but you keep hearing them.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Hartman, can you help us out a little bit here on the pathology of transferring back and forth between deer and cattle? One deer goes running by at 20 miles an hour. Does he catch that airborne, or how close does the contact have to be over what period of time, and so on?
Dr. Hartman, do they have to kiss?
Mr. Chair and Representative Doty, the disease is a respiratory disease for the most part, and so it's in the lungs, in the lymph nodes in the lungs, and oftentimes what happens is the animal that has the disease will cough it up, it'll get in the saliva, and so it is either nose-to-nose contact, so you'd have a cow and a deer, or a cow and a cow, or a deer and a deer, that were nose to nose, and they it could actually spread in the air very short distances. And that's why it's important how concentrated these animals are, because the more interaction they have, the more likely to spread. The other method that it may be transmitted is in standing water. So if you have a container of water and there are animals infected and it's in their saliva, it'll get in the water and it may be a high enough dose to transmit to another animal. Or it can also be in the feed. And in the right, they did some research on this in Michigan, and in the right conditions, the bacteria likes dark, it likes cool, and it likes moist. So if you put it in some feed that has those conditions, it can last up to 4 months in that feed.
Any other questions? Seeing none. Oh, Dr. Hartman.
Mr. Chair, just a final comment. We are working on legislation to give the Board of Animal Health more authority that we need to manage this zone up there. We are looking at what sort of resource needs we have, and those issues will be coming to you. The other thing that we're doing is we've started conversations with the University of Minnesota to look at some research on why this disease is spreading, and are there things that we could do differently to attack it stronger.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you for coming with that update, and we will be addressing this further, members. And if there's no further business, meeting is adjourned.